So I'm now going to be introducing our next speaker, Dr. Jacques Mathieu, co-founder and acting CEO of Sentinel Environmental, where they are building better microbiomes, as well as being a co-founder of Advanced Microbiotics, a startup focused on developing therapeutics to combat antibiotic-resistant bacteria. He also has a background in environmental engineering at Rice University, and I'm really excited to hear what you're going to talk about regarding fecal microbiota transplantation as an immediate healthspan intervention. So over to you.
All right. So, as I was mentioning, I think that, microbiome engineering is a really good fit for DAL, and specifically what I'm about to talk about today, fecal microbiota transplantation. To provide a little background, and specifically the panel earlier today also mentioned the motivation for doing this research. And I had sort of some personal motivation for talking about FMTs, because in 2011, my father was diagnosed with leukemia. And 2 years after that, he was diagnosed with stage two melanoma. The leukemia was CLL. It wasn't really much of an issue. But the stage two melanoma, he got treated, a couple surgeries, a couple different things. But a year later, it recurred and developed into metastatic stage four melanoma. The doctors at that point, they kind of gone through their standard of care. They told him, sorry, nothing else we can do. Go ahead and get your affairs in order. And that was it. So obviously, I was upset by that. I was also confused a little bit because, I knew there was a lot of treatments and clinical trials and a lot of things they hadn't tried. And I really wasn't sure why they weren't doing that. And so obviously I started arguing with his doctors. I started contacting PIs from these different clinical trials. And what I found was that there was really this unwillingness to provide my father with these treatments. And it really took a lot of work and a lot of frustration, but a lot of time and energy. And I got to the point where I was literally standing outside people's offices, just waiting because they weren't returning emails or phone calls. And eventually I got my father immunotherapy. 2 weeks after he got it, he was in complete remission. And 8 years later, he's still in complete remission. Now I'm saying this story because my father was lucky because he had an advocate and he had, not everybody has somebody with a, PhD in the biological sciences that understands the literature, that understands what's available, and that can really push and help get you what you need, right? So I think we're at a place right now where science and medicine is really progressing extremely fast. And we're in a situation, though, where these doctors who are really busy doing their jobs, a lot of them might be uninformed about what's out there. And in general, most patients are going to be even less informed than their doctors are. And I think that this leads to a lot of unnecessary death and suffering. Now, a lot of my early research, in doing aging interventions, I've been working in the field from 2005 with the Methuselah Foundation, later the SENS Foundation, and then I spun off a couple companies a little bit later. Some of the research I was doing, even though it was really promising, I often asked myself, when is this going to be of benefit to people? 5, 10, probably 20 years in the future, if ever. And I really started kind of looking at what I thought the, lower hanging fruit was. And around the same time, I sort of came to this realization, I started seeing, everybody started seeing these associations between the microbiome and all these different conditions. Today, it's almost every condition is associated to the microbiome. And if we look at the top 10 leading causes of death by the CDC, you'll see that 9 of them have very strong microbial associations, with the exception of unintentional injuries. Okay. But sometimes it seems like there's almost too much, right? There's so much data coming out. It's a little bit overwhelming. And I think people kind of like, oh, yeah, the microbiome's associated with everything. Is it really, Well, I think it helps to have a perspective here on why the microbiome might actually be involved in so many different things and really sit at the center of sort of our health span. For example, there's 10 to the 13th, 10 to the 14th cells in your gut and about 200 to 1,000 different bacterial species encoding over 1 million unique bacterial genes. The result of that is that they produce a huge number of metabolites. they transform a lot of different things, like, say, for instance, medicines we ingest. They can make them more or less active. Bacteria are involved in energy regulation. So we're taking in food that normally we wouldn't be able to extract energy out of, but these bacteria are freeing up, some of these bacteria are freeing up that energy for us. One thing that we all know is very important with aging is the immune system. And recent research has really highlighted the importance of the gut microbiome as relate, you know, for the immune system. And in fact, the immune system really uses the gut microbiome as a training ground for itself. If you take the gut microbiome and, like, say, germ-free animals, what we see is a greatly diminished immune system. And then, of course, there's translocation. So there's a lot of bacteria in your gut. Some are probably pathogens. And if given the opportunity, they will enter your blood and cause disease. And so as we get older and we start to see decreased gut integrity, some of these bacteria are translocating. They're going through our bodies. You know, we now know that our bodies aren't sterile as we used to think they are. And so these bacteria get to all parts of our body and they cause issues, right? So yes, there's a lot of bacteria. They do a lot of different things. And that's why they seem to have, you know, so many effects, because they really do, right? Now, to give a more specific example, most people have no idea that 50% of the metabolites in your blood are actually originate from different gut bacteria, okay? Here's a few examples right here. Indoles and bile acids, I'm showing these. There's two different classes of molecule. They're both have been associated with aging positively and negatively, many different derivatives. Indoles are produced by gut bacteria. These specifically secondary bile acids are transformed from bile acids produced from our bodies, but they're transformed by gut bacteria into these secondary bile acids, which enter our blood. They're enriched in centenarians. They can have pro-longevity effects, right? So one example, TMAO is probably the prototypical example of a gut metabolite that I think has strong causal links to cardiovascular disease. It's also suspected in chronic kidney disease. Neurotransmitters are another really interesting example. A lot of people don't know that the first antidepressants were actually antibiotics. They discovered them by trying to treat people for tuberculosis. Also, 90% of the serotonin, you know, a lot of people think, oh, serotonin is made by my brain. Well, no, 90% is actually made by your gut bacteria. GABA, dopamine are another example. Many neuroactive peptides are produced by gut bacteria, and they can control different things, such as, for instance, your appetite, right? Short-chain fatty acids are another example. These are anaerobic fermentation products. One example is butyrate, which provides energy for colonocytes. It's associated with many different physiological processes. Okay, so bacteria producing a lot of things that make their way into your blood, that have, you know, they're very active and they're just having wide systemic effects. So a lot of people have never actually seen microbiome data, real microbiome data. What's it look like? These are two, this is two data sets. These are recent. These are people I know. They gave me their data, allowed me to share it. And the reason I'm showing you this here is because, you know, previously I mentioned, you know, there could be up to 1,000 different species in your gut. And so when you start talking about intervening in the microbiome and trying to manipulate it, shift its function in a particular way, that seems like a really challenging issue. Okay. But what I want to point out here is down is you notice that these are the top 20 species in each of these individuals' guts. And together, if you sum them up, they make over 80% or up to 90% of the gut bacteria in each of those individuals. And so what we've seen in the gut microbiome is that these species distribution really follows with this, what's called as power law distribution, meaning that there's a high abundance of few species and then a much lower abundance of a lot more species, right? And the reason this is important is because when we're talking about microbiome engineering, how can we shift our gut microbiome function? This actually makes the problem much more manageable, because what we can do is we can just focus on these more highly abundant species, right, that are doing most of the work. This follows this Pareto's principle, or that 80-20 rule, pretty much to a T, right? Now, as far as the gut microbiota and aging, it's been shown to mediate aging in multiple animal species. Almost everything investigated, there's been this link established, C. elegans, Drosophila, many, many mice studies. And what all these studies have done is really shown us this pattern of what's occurring with aging in the microbiome. And generally what happens is we see an increase in opportunistic pathogens with a simultaneous decrease in commensals or so-called protective taxa. And this is also associated with increased inflammation and increased age-related conditions or diseases. Okay. Now, the rate, what makes the difference, we believe, now between healthy aging and unhealthy aging is, to a large part, how fast or slow those pathogens are displacing those commensals in your gut. Now, the animal models have shown that the human data is a little bit more confusing. But there's a big problem with a lot of these studies, and I'll just put this out there, is that they use what's called cross-sectional data. So they go to a bunch of different people, like centenarians, they get a single sample, and then they try to analyze it. We now know that is an awful way of doing microbiome research because the microbiome is very dynamic. Now, it's considered stable because it has an equilibrium around a certain stable state, but it's highly dynamic, meaning any species can fluctuate 100-fold day to day. That makes cross-sectional snapshots kind of useless, right? You need multiple time points to figure out what that equilibrium is, right? But in general, healthy aging in humans has been associated with increasing compositional uniqueness, expansion of rare commensals, depletion of core taxa, okay? Conversely, unhealthy aging is associated with low uniqueness, pathogen expansion, and maintenance of these certain core taxa. This creates a little bit of a controversy because a lot of microbiome researchers have found fairly consistently that a well-functioning, healthy microbiome, if it's in the same environment, like the gut microbiome, healthy gut microbiomes all tend to be alike. Just like those two individuals I showed you, they're very different, right? But their microbiomes, at least the top species, were very similar, okay? On the other hand, unhappy families or dysfunctional microbiomes tend to be really different, okay? But that's not what we're really seeing with these human studies. I think in the near future, we'll resolve this, but it's still an unsettled question. Nevertheless, we do know pretty well what a dysbiotic microbiome looks like. And so if we know what a dysbiotic microbiome looks like, is there something that we can do to correct it? By far, the vast number of studies have looked at four different ways to do this. Diet, of course, probiotics, antibiotics, and to a much more limited degree, FMT, fecal microbiota transplantation, okay? Now, these range in their efficacy, their specificity. Of course, diet is kind of nonspecific and is really not that effective. What we've seen with diet is that you need a long-term sustained change in diet to actually be sufficient to induce what we call a change in the microbiome state, stable state, okay? Now, on the other hand, probiotics are very specific. You're adding a single organism for putatively a specific function. The problem, though, is it's just not effective. I'll get to that why in the next slide. But then, of course, then we have antibiotics. Antibiotics are like playing Russian roulette. They're highly effective. They kill a lot of stuff, but non-specifically, you just don't know what's going to happen afterwards, right? And then, of course, there's FMT. FMT, again, not very specific. However, with FMT, they're very effective for certain conditions, and we can at least get an idea of the overall function of that microbiome that we're trying to transplant into the individual. There's a lot of other technologies that are being developed for selective microbiome engineering. My own group, my lab, we work every day with phages developing these, lots of projects around that. But the problem with these technologies is they're 5 years out, 10 years out. Okay, they're still years out. They're not there yet, right? So what do we do today to help people? So probiotics, are something that a lot of people are taking today. I have a problem with probiotics because I think they're giving the whole field a little bit of a snake oil feel, okay? We now know that probiotics are usually ineffective because they fail to colonize and the doses that most people are taking are just insufficient for it, okay? And this is probably being harmful to the overall field, which is why I'm mentioning this. I'll give you an example. There's about, if we say 10 to the 13th cells in your colon, average person, let's use Akkermansia, really expensive probiotic that a lot of people in the aging community are taking, maybe good, maybe bad, average person has 3% Akkermansia in your gut. That means one dose of the probiotic is about 0.03% of that community, right? It's a drop in the bucket. You also need to consider that very few of those cells are actually going to maintain their viability as they transit through your gut and make it to the colon. So we see this a lot, right? And there's really no big surprise that probiotics you know, these clinical trials have been relatively unimpressive. But I think in the future, there will be a lot of, you know, really great uses for probiotics once we figure out how to ensure colonization. But in the meantime, what I'm really talking about is FMT and as an aging intervention, okay? And the basis for my argument here is that, one, FMT is available now, today. People are getting FMTs. People got them today. People got them 10 years ago, okay? This is a procedure that we know how to do that's being used, okay? They're also very accessible. Let's face it. I mean, you know, feces isn't, you know, we're not lacking feces, okay? Proven effective for a wide variety, you know, for at least for gut dysbiosis and for CDI, really effective. They're also considered pretty safe, okay? And then potentially reversible. And what I mean by that is if you do an FMT, and you don't like the outcome, you know, there is the possibility you could go out, clear yourself out, and do it over again, or replace your previous microbiota, okay? The picture I've got up here with these five red capsules, that's how easy an FMT could be, because that is one FMT treatment right there that's, you know, been developed, and you can just take that at home, right? Anybody can take that pill form. Now, briefly, FMTs. There's been over 50,000 in the US performed as of like 2019. There were a few serious adverse effects, okay, not many, but there were two FMT-related deaths. Those were due to pathogenic E. coli, which got transferred in the FMT. Those organisms are now screened for specifically. And then, of course, COVID halted one of the main program in the U.S. that was being run by Open Biome, but I think that's sort of started up now again. Now, FMT is FDA authorized for treatment of recurrent CDI, no IND required. However, an IND is required to use to treat it for any other condition. The stool, the same, you know, the material can be acquired from a bank like Open Biome, a known person, you know, somebody you're familiar with their medical history, or from, you know, the recipient themselves. We call that autologous FMT. FMT procedures can vary considerably, including delivery method. As I mentioned, it could be an ingested capsule. It could be something like a colonoscopy, right? The dose matters. How you prepare the FMT material varies between studies. The number of FMTs they give, some do one FMT, some do multiple. And then, of course, there's what we call microbiota depletion prior to the FMT. Do you get rid of the existing microbial population? Now, although we haven't done these studies in humans, there have been studies looking at young FMT into old animals, and they all show the same thing. Young FMT mitigates multiple hallmarks of aging and extends lifespan. This was done in Drosophila, of course. And what we see here is killifish, African killifish, which is really interesting. They were able to extend the maximum lifespan there, 37%. There's been a lot of mouse studies that have been done, including in these progeroid mouse models, where they found the lifespan was extended about 13.5%. And, you know, they just showed FMT really improves multiple hallmarks of aging in these mice. All right. Now, from these animals and in human studies, we've learned how to increase FMT, what controls FMT efficacy, right? And predominantly, you know, it's really dependent on existing dysbiosis and the treatment, you know. And so if we just look at recurrent CDI, you see a really, really high success rate for FMT on the order of 90 to 100%, depending on the study. Okay. And in CDI, the thing to think about is these patients have probably undergone multiple, you know, regimens of antibiotics. So they're just taking a lot of antibiotics. They all come in with serious gut dysbiosis. So, you know, you can see in the red here are the donor strains versus the recipient strains. You know, so when you have this prior dysbiosis, the donor engrafts, you know, has a much higher success rate, as we see. Now, these other conditions, metabolic syndrome, cancer immunotherapy, IBD, multi-drug resistant bacteria, they may or may not have pre-existing gut dysbiosis. And so if we look at these two studies here down this little gray bar, these two studies, what they did was they treated with antibiotic to deplete the microbiota, but they also gave this oral lavage, which, you know, clears you out. And the combination of the two, researchers have found, really, really does the trick as far as ensuring donor engraftment, as you can see here and here. You have a much, much higher donor engraftment in that case, okay? We also know that increased donor alpha diversity helps improve strain engraftment. And also for specific strains, tax identity and their abundance are the biggest determinants of whether or not they colonize. Now, interestingly, FMT efficacy may be independent of bacteria, at least in some cases. So FMTs also contain proteins, metabolites, and phages, right? And what we found is that some researchers decided to filter their samples. So we call that fecal filtrate transplantation. They found that this was as effective as FMT for recurrent CDI in a small patient trial, at least. So it's really interesting. And a lot of the researchers are attributing this to the presence of phages in these samples. And so fecal viral transfer was shown to decrease symptoms of type 2 diabetes and obesity in mice. Fecal viral transfer shifted microbiome composition towards that of the donor and other studies. So this is really an interesting area of research. And of course, I mentioned my group works in phages and we're highly interested in this. Right now, there's hundreds of FMT clinical trials in the US and the rest of the world, looking at almost every different condition you can imagine. A lot of them, what we associate, you know, we call age-related diseases, you know, obesity, diabetes, you know, cardiovascular disease, Parkinson's, you name it. And these are great, but there's a problem, right? The problem is that these studies are one, designed around the specific condition. Two is that they're ongoing. It may be years and years before we know how these studies did. We know what the benefits were, or you know, this makes its way into the clinic. So, you know, what happens in the meantime? Well, there have been a lot of case studies, I should also mention. Now, these lack statistical significance in most cases, right? But they do help, you know, us identify what the power of FMT could really be. One of the most interesting I found was that three multiple sclerosis patients had major sustained reversal symptoms post-FMT. One was wheelchair bound and could walk shortly after, you know, and this was done in a range of ages here. Really interesting, this one recently came out, a bipolar patient had FMT, and afterwards they were able to cease medication. They had an absence of ADHD symptoms, reduced resting heart rate, just tremendous improvements that were validated by, you know, clinically validated as well. Okay, not just this person's experience. FMT showed to alleviate multiple organ dysfunction syndrome, usually sepsis related in elderly patients, right? And actually people have seen Parkinson's disease symptoms have shown improvement in a few studies, right? So this really has the potential to be powerful treatment for a lot of people. Now, in the future, you know, I feel like microbiome engineering, this is what we're working towards, really a design, build, test, learn sort of system so that we can rationally design treatments that make very selective modifications to people's microbiomes to achieve specific functional or, you know, health-related outcomes. Okay, I think this is the future where things are going. I think there's a huge amount of research in this area, but we're not there yet. This is going to be years until something like this is going to actually start helping people. The problem with that is obviously 100,000 people are dying every day due to age-related causes. Is there anything we can do about that, right? I mean, that's what I want to do. I want to push technologies that can benefit the most people now. Right now, we don't know how to selectively engineer microbiomes for optimal health, but FMTs we don't need to know as much about the microbiome, okay? What we need to know about is how healthy are the people that are harboring those microbiomes, right? So we use accepted measurements of donor health as a proxy here. That's allowed FMT risks to really be low, and likely, probably these risks are going to be acceptable for a lot of patients that are in declining health. Because once your health trajectory kind of is going in a bad direction, unless you do something about it, it's probably going to continue that direction, right? Now, this quote was from the Georgetown University bioethics blog, you know, where they say, you know, many deaths, you know, are faster or slower, right? Faster or slower than those concerned would have preferred. Dying too slowly is the far larger error. These individuals are restricted from a more comfortable and peaceful death by their clinicians by law or by their own lack of advanced care planning. I think we're getting to the point where the opposite of that might be true. At least in my dad's case, I know that was true, right? Dying too quickly might start to be the far larger error, you know, if these clinicians aren't informed and patients aren't informed of the things that can help them. And, you know, individuals may be restricted from a more comfortable and peaceful life by this lack of knowledge, right? So what do we do to change that? How do we move forward? How do we, you know, I've been working in phage therapy for years. Phage therapy has been around for 100 years. It can save people that have antibiotic resistant infections, and it's done so. Yet 1.9 million people are dying per year, right? Why? Because lack of knowledge and a lack of resources. Okay, so what we need to do to move forward is we need to inform most, you know, mostly, right? Clinicians need to be informed, and they should be conducting FMT on the basis of current existing evidence. Patients need to be informed, right? Especially for non-CDI conditions. And they should be aware of the clinical trials, and they should enroll in those when possible and appropriate. There's going to be a lot of severely ill patients, those that are just aging, right? You know, there's no alternative. No doctor is going to treat you for aging. But, you know, people could consider FMT, and they could consider FMT using expanded access or right to try. I think the other thing that could make a big difference here is really open community initiatives, DAOs, right? Life-saving data should not be a commodity. It should be a common good. I don't think, you know, personally, I'm not in this for the money. I'm in this to benefit the most people as quickly as possible. In that regard, you know, as far as open community initiatives, high resolution time series data is mandatory here, and we need to track people's outcomes as much as possible, while, of course, you know, keeping things anonymous. And lastly, you know, as far as data goes, human data is just much, much, much more valuable than animal data. There's reasons for this, but let me just say that there's host selection within the human gut, right? We our immune systems intentionally control what species are really, you know, what are there, and, you know, and exclude other species. It's going to be different in animals. That host control is going to be different in a mouse than it is from a human. Okay. We should encourage stool banking during periods of good health. Autologous FMT is the safest approach we could use. It's your own material, and it can serve as an insurance policy against heterologous FMTs that you might get from another donor. Also, FMT after antibiotics should be considered, because antibiotics are destroying it. I just saw an article, I think it was in Science, that said every time you take an antibiotic, you're really putting your health at risk, right? And finally, I think there's some things that we could do very quickly, you know, that would really help accelerate the field. And the number one thing, I think, is to design studies around age-adjusted FMT. And what I mean by that is compare healthy young donors to healthy age-matched donors for a particular recipient to see what provides the most effect, the best effect, the best outcome. So with that, that ends my talk. Anybody interested in discussing further, please contact me at either of those email addresses.
Thank you so much, Jack, for that really, really fascinating presentation. I actually have so many questions, but we only probably have time for a couple. And so if you can answer any of them on the chat afterwards, that'd be really great. So firstly, as you just sort of mentioned with this autologous FMT, how long can you store the FMT samples? And with the generic FMT approaches, how are they sort of standardized? And how do you, I mean, you mentioned about screening, but how do you sort of standardize, and then how does that affect doing clinical trials, et cetera?
Yeah, so the standardization process, this has been going on for a long time. So Open Biome has been doing this. They're not doing it now, but they partnered, I think it's University of Minnesota. And, you know, screening and being a donor is actually, they joking around, it's harder than getting into Harvard. They do, you know, a lot of, they're doing blood work, they're characterizing the stool, they're looking at this person's health, there's questionnaires, psychological stuff, right? So, and it gets better all the time. How you process it, right now they can process it aerobically, and they can freeze and store it for a long time. And at least for CDI, it's effective. That may not be true for other conditions, okay? And so the big thing is anaerobic versus aerobic, because in the colon, a lot of our bacteria are anaerobic. So we want to investigate how keeping things anaerobic and maintaining those bacteria, keeping them viable, will enhance the outcomes for other conditions. I think that's important, but it can be stored for a long time.
Thank you. And one final quick question. Obviously, we've spoken about the gut microbiome, but there's also the oral microbiome and the skin. Do you think there's any potential long-term for therapeutics in terms of manipulating those microbiomes?
Sure. I've got projects right now working on skin and oral microbiomes, looking at using phages in this case, But I do think, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we have the most information about the gut microbiome, obviously. And we should have a lot more. I think there'll be a lot more interest in the oral microbiome. And, you know, we see people with periodontal disease are more at risk for many different conditions. And that's probably because the bacteria are getting in through the circulation and stuff there. And so there's a lot of interest in that area. But there's also things like, hey, brush your teeth and take care of your oral health that are really powerful as well, too. Right. And I think, intervening in the gut microbiome, I think might have a little bit more impact overall. But I think, looking at it holistically is important.
Yeah, for sure. Like, really good points. So thank you again for this presentation. I should probably pass on now back to Max to introduce our next speaker. But yes, thank you for this talk.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Shaq. Very interesting.